Today, a journey through crisis-stricken Venezuela to see how the country's children are faring. And, with London Fashion Week in full swing, we look at the feminist power of the humble pocket.
We're in a paediatric emergency department, all huddled around a bed containing Lucianis, who's just turned one. The doctors had made a little cake, blue and pink birthday cake. Her mum is standing by her bedside with a cell phone making a video. The doctors and the residents in the hospital are all singing happy birthday. It was a lovely first birthday, and for a moment the whole Venezuelan crisis just sort of faded away. And it was strange because just a few days earlier, doctors had worried that she was going to become the fourth baby to die in the hospital that week.
The Guardian's Latin America correspondent, Tom Phillips, recently visited hospitals, schools and family homes in Venezuela a year after Juan Guaido launched his bid to force Nicolas Maduro from power.
Hundreds of thousands of people are pouring into the streets of Venezuela to protest against the administration of Nicolas Maduro. And now opposition leader Juan Guaido has declared himself the country's new president.
The attempt to spark an uprising fizzled out, leading to political deadlock. Meanwhile, the enduring economic depression is taking its toll on the country's youngest citizens. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the children of the Venezuelan crisis. Tom, the last time we spoke about Venezuela was May 2019. Why did you decide to go back now?
We decided to go back because in many ways the media seems to have disconnected and the world seems to have forgotten a bit about the Venezuela story over the last 6 months. We are now into year seven of one of the most severe economic collapses outside a war zone in modern history. And we've had almost 5 million people fleeing the country from hyperinflation, no work, impossible to get food, medicine shortages. The country is absolutely on its knees. And we wanted to look at how this was affecting the most vulnerable citizens in Venezuela, the kids.
Tell us about your journey.
So I flew into Caracas in mid-January, and it was the first time I'd been there for 5 or 6 months. Last year, the planes going into Caracas were often quite empty, and it was very eerie flying into this airport that didn't have very much electricity, and everything felt very dead. And it was quite strange flying in from Panama, actually, because the plane flying into Caracas was actually massively overbooked, and I think there were about 20 passengers who didn't manage to get on board, which I thought was odd. And then when you land in Caracas, the city itself does feel more alive than it did 5 or 6 months ago. Driving around town, you see many, many more cars. You don't see queues at petrol stations in the capital anymore. And we went to these new dollar supermarkets called bodegones, which have opened up in the last 3 or 4 months since Maduro has allowed the dollarization of the economy. Before, if you wanted to buy a cup of coffee in cash, you'd have to have a massive backpack full of wads and wads and wads of cash. And now you can pay for everything in dollars. So for those with access to dollars, for those who are well off, politically connected, life has undoubtedly got better in the 6 months since my last visit.
So is that a sign that things are on the up in Venezuela?
No, I think it would be a real mistake to assume that. It's really, 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 really immediately clear as soon as you just drive a few kilometers out of the capital that this is a bubble. So we decided pretty quickly to get out of the capital. And I was not expecting it to be a positive picture, but I think even by those expectations, it was really shocking what we found.
Where did you decide to go?
So we decided to head out to East Venezuela and to base ourselves in one of the major cities there, a big industrial hub called Ciudad Guayana, and started a 10, 11-hour drive.
Tell me about the journey.
Well, you start to realise that Caracas is a bubble pretty soon after you leave it. that you start to see petrol stations that are closed, and then the ones that are open are being run by members of the military, and there are queues outside. And by the time you're sort of 8-9 hours out of the capital, these queues are days long, 2-3 days, 4 days waiting for petrol in the sun.
Days? What do you mean days? How many cars are you talking about?
I filmed one of them. We were driving at 40 kilometres an hour. I filmed it for about 6 minutes, and it was more than 600 cars.
Wow.
The other really striking thing you see is the sheer number of military and police checkpoints. I counted those two, and between Caracas and our destination, we went through, I think it was 36.
What distance was that over?
A 10-hour journey.
Wow, so that's a checkpoint every 15 minutes or so.
Yeah, where you're stopped. Military officers with Kalashnikovs look in your car. Sometimes they ask you for your documents. They want to know where you're going, what you're doing. It's not an easy ride.
Okay, so you're on the road. You want to talk about children in Venezuela. Where did you arrange to go first?
So the first place we went was the paediatric emergency department in what is now the major hospital in Venezuela's biggest state, Bolivar, which is where we were based. We arrived there on a Friday morning, and one of the first things we learned was that already that week, 3 babies had died there of issues arising from severe malnutrition, and that a fourth baby was in the room next door fighting for her life. And it was an awful scene. There was a 16-year-old mother, Maria, being asked to leave the room so doctors could concentrate. She was in real distress, as you might imagine. And Lucianis, this small baby, was lying on a hospital bed, terrified and grimacing in pain. It was awful. It was awful. I mean, just you immediately imagine what it would be like if that was your kid lying on the bed there. And the doctors were telling us that that day she'd already had, I think, 24, 25 bouts of diarrhea. She was completely dehydrated and had been in this state for a couple of weeks.
What's going on? Why are infant mortality rates so high?
So a big part of it is a lot of the mothers are so malnourished themselves. They're all malnourished. I mean, Maria was extremely skinny too, as was her mum. Like 80% of Venezuelans, they are living in poverty. They can't afford formula because a can costs what even a teacher might earn in several months. So they end up giving them things like rice cream, wheat flour, cornmeal. They'll mix spaghetti with water, things like that, which don't contain any protein. You notice a large number of kids there with problems that they probably would not have had before the crisis.
Lucianis, who you were telling me about, is the little girl whose birthday you described at the start. And I know that there was some good news there, that after real worries about her health, she seemed to be improving and on the way to recovery. Who else did you meet?
Across the room, another family who 24 hours earlier had lost their 3-month-old daughter, Yuretsi.
Oh my God, how are they coping?
So they were tending to Yuretsi's sister. She was a twin, and her very young mother, Yangelis, just looked, as you might imagine, absolutely stunned.
How are the staff in the hospital, the doctors and the nurses, dealing with all of this?
Well, they're fantastic, actually. And I think that's one of the most uplifting things about covering such a horrific humanitarian crisis in Venezuela is the people you meet on the front line who are still here fighting to do something about it, like the doctors. These are just incredible people who are working in dire conditions. Until very recently, until UNICEF turned up in the last couple of months, the paediatric emergency department had not had running water. I mean, can you imagine? How are you supposed to treat any kind of patient or run any kind of hospital if you don't have clean water? But a lot of them, unfortunately, are leaving. There's been a huge exodus of doctors and teachers too are leaving in their droves.
You mentioned teachers. That's another integral part of a child's life. And that was the story you were there to tell. I mean, what is happening in the schools?
So that's exactly what we wanted to find out. So our next stop was El Palmar, which is a really small rural community a few hours east of the city where we were staying. And we turned up there one morning and we weren't expecting the school to be in a fantastic condition, obviously, but it was unbelievable. And immediately we were sort of jumped on by the teachers who just immediately wanted to show us around, to show the sort of situation that they were facing. First thing you notice is there's no light. There are no light bulbs, there's no electricity in the school. There were no chairs, there were no tables. And you go into the toilets and there are no toilet bowls and there are no sinks and bits of the wall are missing and all the sockets have been taken. And you start to realise that you're not really walking around the school, you're walking around sort of, I mean, it feels like an archaeological site. And yet, bizarrely, there are still kids studying there and they sit on the floor every day. I mean, it just felt like something from another era.
That's extraordinary. I mean, what's this experience like for the children?
Pretty tough. And the parents are very angry and the teachers are very angry. And the morning we were there, there was an emergency summit being held. And the school's directors, some of whom are political appointees who are connected to the Socialist Party, they had called this meeting to try and ask parents to find ways of chipping in so the kids could actually have something that resembled a school. And this meeting just turned into a complete rebellion against the school's political director, who was there trying to calm people down and, you know, saying it wasn't the government's fault, they were doing their best. One of the people we met was Silvia Marquez, and she was the parents' representative, and she was absolutely furious. And she was waving her hands in the air and shouting, you know, we're going to shut this school down and we're going to shut it down so the ministry comes here and sorts this out once and for all. And they were really angry about how the teachers were being treated too. The teachers are being paid just a few dollars every month. Lots of them are going to the gold mines of the region because there's more money to be made there. I mean, they're just this sheer dedication that these teachers need to be sticking it out when they're not even able to clothe or feed themselves properly. And they were furious about it. And then they marched on the town hall. It was remarkable to see.
Why, Tom, is it so bad? I mean, what on earth is happening that can lead to a school being stripped back that badly?
Well, it's a perfect symbol of the collapse of Venezuela. There are just no more resources. The resources are not reaching schools, even in the capital, let alone in tiny little towns like El Palmar. Part of it is the breakdown in security. There's no one protecting the school, and the thieves just come in and they take what they will because they need to make money too, and leaving the kids with nothing. There are schools all over Venezuela like this. You have tens of thousands of teachers leaving the country. It is a complete disaster. Imagine the impact that is having on these kids.
And it's really interesting when you describe a scene like that, which, you know, pits teachers and parents against a political director who's there on behalf of the government. I guess it leads us to wonder, what is the problem? What is causing this? Is the political director correct that external forces, US sanctions, for example, are playing a part in Venezuela's crisis? Or does this predate that? And is it much more intrinsically linked to the behaviour of the government itself?
There is certainly some truth that in the last year, these sanctions have had a detrimental effect on Venezuela. They've damaged an already completely disintegrating oil industry. But that is not what started this. This is a much longer story, and it is a story of massive, just unbelievable official corruption, of incompetence. The particular school, for example, we visited hasn't had tables or chairs in how long? In 2 years.
Wow. And that exodus of workers that you saw in the school and in the hospital, how big is it more widely?
It's set to become the worst migration crisis in the world this year, a bigger crisis than Syria. It is just, I mean, it's actually impossible to describe. I've done reporting on this from Brazil, from Colombia, from Ecuador, from the US-Mexico border. I met so many families fleeing the country. And I've also actually met a lot of parents who are fleeing the country and leaving their kids behind. And that's always struck me as one of the most awful consequences that you now have almost 1 million Venezuelan children who've been left behind as either mum or dad or both flee abroad to different parts of South America or to the US to try and find work that will help them sustain themselves and their kids back in Venezuela through this crisis, just to survive this thing. I've always wondered what impact that would have on the little ones being left behind with grandmas, with grandpas, with uncles, aunts, sometimes with neighbours, and sometimes just being abandoned altogether on the streets.
Why? Why would they leave their children behind?
Because obviously it's very difficult if you're a Spanish-speaking Venezuelan and you're going into the Brazilian Amazon and you don't speak Portuguese and you need to try and find a job in a region where there are already tens of thousands of Venezuelan refugees looking for jobs. You know, it's difficult to take a small child there with you and to do that. And it is obviously tremendously difficult for those kids who are left behind. So we set out to try and find some of these children who, for different reasons, had been left behind and to try and understand a bit about their lives.
Did you meet any?
We did. So we went to a working class community and we tracked down Joana Lopez, who was a 58-year-old grandmother. She'd raised her own kids. And she was now raising the kids of her next-door neighbour, a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old girl.
Her next-door neighbour?
Her next-door neighbour, Isabel, and she had, because of the crisis, felt that she had no choice but to flee into Guyana. No one knew exactly which part of the country she was in, whether she was in the capital or in a gold mine somewhere. But that's where she was. The kids talked to her every now and again on WhatsApp, and they would cry, and Joana said they'd say, "Mummy, come back, we want to see you." And the girls had actually started calling the next door neighbor, calling Joana mummy. I mean, you could see that she was really, really fighting to give them an ordinary childhood. A lovely room with all these sort of kiddie posters on the walls. And they had this fantasy world out in the garden where they'd used bricks and bits of metal and scraps to sort of build a little tree house and in the mud, and they were, you know, feeding eggshells to their dolls. You know, they're lovely, lovely, happy, happy girls. But obviously just immensely difficult. I mean, Joana, who was still working, she worked in the kitchen of a local school. She said that per fortnight she was earning 180,000 bolivares, which is $2.50 per fortnight, which bought her a bag of rice. So she was not really able to give any kind of proper food to these girls. I think one of the most heartbreaking things I heard during my time in Venezuela was from a child psychologist who I went to interview. And I said, you know, what kind of impact does this have? She said often they wouldn't really like to talk about their feelings. They didn't like to say how they felt about mum or dad being so far away. So she would ask them to draw, and they would be given blank sheets of paper. And these children, a lot of them would just draw themselves in the corner, really, really tiny, tiny depictions of themselves.
Oh, God. It's incredibly tough, incredibly bleak, what you're describing in many ways. But I have to say, I'm also incredibly touched by some of these stories, whether it's the kind of doctors baking the cake for Lucianis or the teachers sitting on the floor in the dark teaching those children, or whether it's Joana bringing up her neighbor's daughters when she's barely got enough money to feed herself. I mean, there are a lot of heartwarming stories in your journey.
Everywhere you go, yeah, everywhere you go, you meet people fighting to help others. You meet people, you know, taking in other people's children. We met a woman who'd adopted a young baby who was abandoned at a hospital, and she'd now raised there for the last 4 years. And she'd been pretty much at death's door from malnutrition too when she was born, and now she was thriving. Yeah, I mean, it makes it uplifting as well as grim, because these people really are determined to get through it and to help others get through it. And that's really humbling to see.
So it sounds like what you've set out, Tom, is a story almost of two Venezuelas, of parts of the capital city, Caracas, in which there's this sense of normality returning. But it feels almost like that's a shop window that hides the real story that you had to get out of the capital to find, a story in which children are at every stage being denied their basic rights, whether it's just being fed, educated, or even simply loved by their parents. I mean, it begs the question, Why aren't there riots on the streets?
Well, it's definitely a shop window, and I think it's very deliberately a shop window. There's clearly been a political calculation there from Maduro and the people around him that Caracas needs to be peaceful. People there need to feel that things are improving. They don't want people marching again as they were last year. And even within the capital, there is huge, huge suffering still in Caracas. I think at the moment there aren't riots on the streets and there aren't big protests like last year because, A, people are just trying to get by. People are just fighting to survive. People thought change had come early last year and they were wrong. And I think people feel a bit deflated too at the moment and are waiting for something. They don't know what, but for something to change.
Was Guaido the wrong alternative? Were people too suspicious of his relationship with the US?
I think people are definitely suspicious of his relationship with the US. I think he's been forced by circumstance to choose some pretty unsavoury allies, appearing on Fox News and...
Joining us in the gallery is the true and legitimate president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido. Mr. President.
Being in the White House and being received by Donald Trump, absolutely. I don't think that's been helpful.
Please take this message back that all Americans are united with the Venezuelan people in their righteous struggle for freedom. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
And Maduro's government knows this full well, and that is why they have decked the highways and streets of Caracas with all of these multicolored propaganda posters that say, no more Trump. They want you to think it's all Donald Trump.
What's Guaido doing now?
He's just been on a world tour, so he was in Europe, he met with Boris Johnson, he met with Trudeau in Canada. He's obviously scrambling to ensure that international support does not fade, because he is still recognised by almost 60 governments as the rightful interim president of Venezuela. He addressed a rally in Miami recently, and he said, he told the crowd of mostly Venezuelans, all options are on the table, and then he added, but they're under it too. And he wanted to hint by saying that you know, behind the scenes, things are going on and talks are going on that are going to bring about the downfall of Maduro. Well, who knows what's going on under the table? We just don't know. And I think there is a certain despondency setting in among some allies that if this goes on for another 6 months, a year, he's finished.
And whatever the reason for what we're seeing, and there are arguments about it, what you've just witnessed is a humanitarian crisis within Venezuela, which is even worse than the last time we discussed this same crisis. I mean, what should the world be doing to intervene?
Since last year, when Maduro recognised that there was a humanitarian crisis going on in Venezuela, we've seen an increase in the amount of aid getting in Venezuela and also along its borders to help the refugees who are pouring out. I think that is absolutely crucial. And I think, secondly, just don't forget the story. It feels to me that in the last six months, the world's attention has wandered. And yet this is still such a big emergency. It is so important. And it's really, really important that the world doesn't forget Venezuela.
That was Tom Phillips, The Guardian's excellent Latin America correspondent. He's written a powerful series of reports on his journey through Venezuela, looking at the impact of the crisis on children. Do read them at theguardian.com. Coming up, London Fashion Week has started, and our associate fashion editor has something to say about the politics of pockets. Now, does it matter if dresses have pockets? The Guardian's Jess Kartner-Morley thinks that it does.
I've lost count of the number of times that I've complimented a woman on what she's wearing and she's responded by saying, yes, isn't it great, it's got pockets. Pockets is a really serious issue in fashion. They change the whole style from being just decorative to being functional and something that's helping you go about your day. I think pockets have really come back into fashion over the last decade for two reasons. One being there's been a real rise in prominence in female designers in fashion over the last few years, and women tend to put pockets on clothes because they see clothes as functional rather than something that they're purely making as art or as design. I think the other reason is that the pocket has become more important in our lives as the amount of stuff we have to carry around has become smaller through technology. Because in the 1980s, if you were a woman going to work for the day, you had a Filofax, you had all kinds of stuff that you had to carry around. And now you can spend a day with your phone, your keys, and that's it. If you go back to like the 18th century, women had what were called pockets, which were actually more like what we would now call maybe a bum bag, because it was kind of a belt which had pockets on it, but you had one on each hip, and you wore that between your petticoat and your overskirt, and that was called pockets, but it wasn't actually in the garment. You had little slits in the side of your coat. Pockets became an issue towards the end of the 19th century when the silhouette for women really slimmed down and you couldn't any longer hide a pocket underneath what you were wearing, and suddenly the pocket or the lack of a pocket became obvious to everyone around you. So at the beginning of the 20th century, around the same time that there's a movement against corsets, there is a movement pro-pockets. I think those two things kind of sit together in terms of the sort of feminist history of fashion. There was a suit called the suffragette suit, sort of around 1910, 1911, which was a skirt suit which had six pockets on it, which was revolutionary in its time. And not long after that came Coco Chanel, and her famous skirt suit always has patch pockets on the jacket and often patch pockets on the skirt as well. She made that kind of slouchy functionality very much a part of her aesthetic. One of the reasons why pockets fell out of favour in the 20th century was the industrialisation of fashion. If you go back and look at patterns for dressmaking, Vogue patterns, lots of pockets on almost everything. Day dresses, skirts, suits will all have pockets when women were making clothes domestically or in small scale. But once the making of clothes passed into the hands of brands, those pockets kind of disappeared because it was more in the interest of those brands to make a dress and sell you the dress and then sell you the bag to go with it. I think one of the elements that makes pockets quite loaded aesthetically is that putting your hands in a pocket is quite a masculine way to stand. And it's amazing how much a woman having her hand in a pocket can change how she looks in a portrait. Last year, Angela Kelly, who's the Queen's dresser, wrote a book about dressing the Queen. And one of the things she wrote about in there is that the Queen had always wanted to be photographed with her hands in her pockets. So they actually did a photo shoot in which she was photographed with her hands in her pockets. And those pictures were never used because they weren't approved. They were felt to be not suitably dignified. But they are quite astonishing because of all the thousands and thousands of pictures I've seen of the Queen, no picture has made me kind of stop and sort of do almost a double take as seeing the Queen with her hands in her pockets.
That was The Guardian's associate editor, Jess Kartner-Morley. My thanks to her and to Tom Phillips for his amazing reporting from Venezuela. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Rose Della Rabiti, Courtney Youssef and Gregory Robinson. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. I'm going to be off for the rest of this week, but I'll leave you in the very capable hands of Rachel. See you when I'm back.